Yesterday was a hard shear for me. Today will be, I hope, a little bit easier. The more you think about it, the more it hurts.
What if he would have had a supportive manager, someone to promote him?
It's not a question of that. He never went beyond Shir Hashir. You understand? Never went into Mishlei. And he lived with Kohelet. That he didn't have a problem with.
But a strong admirer who'd work for him to find him a place, no?
It hurts, it hurts. Yeah. We're talking about Klausner. I eulogized him yesterday. I hope, you know, at the OU, I hope it'll be well attended. Again, I don't know how many people attended his classes, but people should come out simply as what I ended off the shiur with yesterday. The Gemara in Shabbos. Yitzchak, at the end of class, I have to show you something. I need your help on. I had a great moment yesterday. I've been working for years on a 1960 picture of the Rav giving shiur, identifying all the students. And yesterday, I think I reached the peak of the mountain, 29 out of 29. But the 29th, it's number 12 actually, I want to give it to you, and I want you to check with Doc Greenspan, with Alan, if that's not his brother-in-law, Izzy Wins, Zichrona Levracha. You follow me? His face, the Rav's hand blocks his face, but I've had correspondence with Saul Berman, Dafka. Saul tells me that's Abba Branch, because it's not Abba Branch, it's number 4, is it? But through Saul, I identified 29. It was his brother-in-law, Ray Weinberg.
My husband. You don't really see Alan.
You don't really see the face, but the gish.
No, I mean, Alan Greenspan, I don't see.
Can you email him? You were closer to him than I was here. You went to whatever, but see if you can email him. Okay, and if not, reach him somehow. It's very important. Okay, let's begin. Today is September 2018, and I say good morning to my students in front of me, and I hope that my dear student Simon Italiano will realize how important it is. People already complained to me a few minutes ago that it wasn't up. At 10 o'clock last night, they checked it was not up. When did it go up? 10:15 last night. Okay. Baruch Hashem. Okay. I just want to mention today is a yahrzeit of many students of mine. Jack checked it out and told me today is the equivalent of 9/11 on the our calendar. And 9/11, I need not tell you, among the thousands who died were students of mine from all the schools I taught in. And the Kollel had a miracle. Jonathan Pizer should have been there at that time, and he was late because of Slichus, that the whole morning began late for him, and when he reached the Twin Towers, the first building had gone down already, and he ran back, and his life was saved. I have other students who perished, Machon Gold, BMT, people worked there. One lady from Midrashit Moriah walked down 35 flights, didn't listen. They originally announced everyone should stay at their desks. And she didn't listen. But she had, afterwards, she needed a lot of psychological help. You know, imagine everyone in your office is dead and you're the only one who survives. But thank God, as the years went by, her life was able to straighten out. So I recall what we have gone through, and if you listen carefully to yesterday's eulogy at the end, that probably was more important than anything I said yesterday. That's hitting the nail on the head. Maybe I'll repeat it Thursday night, Be'ezrat Hashem. Thursday night, I'm more limited in time, so I don't want to, you know, don't want to be a hedgehog called Fates LaRoche. There are two speakers coming after me, and I told them the whole program has to be an hour and a half. You can't take an audience and bore them for 4 or 5. I've seen it already, where people rave on and rave on. Someone told me about the YU graduation. there were so many speakers, and they made it in the Madison Square Garden. There were more people outside wandering back and forth, talking, meeting friends, cupping something to eat, than the people inside listening to the speeches. Someone told me there were like 36 different speeches. I do want to mention today a great man died. Jünger des Sohn ist starben, but someone I knew quite well, I taught his children, his grandchildren, Milton Kramer. Does the name mean anything to you? Kramer family. Generally, if you know Kramers that are from, that have been in America 100 years, more than 100 years, it's part of this family. And they brought Chabad to America. And Milton Kramer, who died at 99 years of age, I just was together with him this past summer in Shaarei Tefillah in Lawrence. He youthful. And what was the greatest moment of his life? Here's a man who came from a well-to-do family, successful in business. His grandfather, his uncle, his father, everyone in the family, they brought the sixth Rebbe to America when he visited America in 28, 29. The farewell party was at his uncle's home, and there's a movie of the farewell party, a beautiful movie, a silent movie, but a movie. These people had a movie camera, and it took, and Chabad refurbished it, and there is this 10-year-old kid, and his grandmother and his uncle and his father push him and say, sing. You don't hear it on the movie, but he tells the story, zing for the Rebbe. And there's this 10-year-old kid singing, had a good voice, and the Rebbe, you could see, is sitting there with such hana. And this was Milti Kramer, and I want to dedicate the Shia in his memory, and I condolences to the children and the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, what a family. Now, a few little corrections. Jeff Francis, Rabbi Francis, writes to me, you had an exchange with the Talmud Simon Italianda in the Shir on Kaddish. I forwarded the link of the recording to his father who lives here in Atlanta. I'm sure he will get nachas. To add to the praise of this fellow's father, he's a Yerusha Mayim, an outstanding balabayat and the gabbai of one of the minyanim of Rabbi Feldman's shul. So he found his roots and planted himself. He's even responsible for opening a badly needed dairy restaurant in the Atlanta community. So that's your father's business, or that's a side interest?
He opened about half a year ago.
And how's it doing?
Amazing.
Okay, now, I am very happy to hear that, because I only eat milkshakes if I can avoid the flesh. But here, then I mentioned the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. So my dear student, Stephen Wagner, and I send regards to him and to Tammy, and I know this, but I guess I didn't mention it. Following Rabbi Mark Angel, Rabbi Chaim Angel was the rabbi of Spanish-Portuguese. He's a graduate of the Kollel. He was my Talmud in the Kollel. And then Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik took over. Trudy Wise Rosemarin, this is from England, from Jacob Sasson, no, so this is from America. He tells me that, remember I mentioned she went conservative and she was angry at the rabbinate, and her one and only son, Rav Moshe, is the author of the Dvar Moshe, 15 volumes on many mesechtot in Shas. So I was correct. I knew that her son, I didn't realize it's an only son, he is Tzadik Yisod Olam. Now, this is very funny, because this is an event that I gave one version of, Morty gave another version, and now we have a third version. Remember I told you about the Baltimore boat ride that was treif, and people were throwing up, and there were geisatinus. So I remember what I read in the Israeli newspapers. I probably said it was in the 70s, John Jacobson of evidently Baltimore says the Baltimore boat was in the 88 or 89 and was a fundraiser for Camp Shoresh. What is Camp Shoresh, Morty? A day camp. So now you have my version. Your version was for a Talmud Torah, Gdanks. No. And now you have a third version. My sister was there, and although always heard rumors of people throwing up, she never really saw it happen. So all I can say is it's like a Hasidic story today, but the essence of the story is true. Okay, now back here. Today's a very, very fascinating Shayura, and you have to listen without prejudice to try to understand what the 20s were like. Here's Reb Lazer Silva, and this man, he was different. He had a big foot in the old Rabbinisha world, but he had a small foot in the new world. And the more he remained in America, the more it shifted gears. By the time he died, it was only a small foot in the old Rabbinisha world and a big foot in the new world. And how do you know Rakefet is right? Mark, I'll bring you a very simple proof. Halacha lemaisa, when he turned 75, who made the big banquet in his honor? The Rabbinical Council of America, not the Agudas HaRabbanim. You follow? Gears shifted. If you look into my book, you'll see a picture of the whole head of the RCA, all the famous American Rabbanim, Rabbi Rachman and everyone else, and honoring Reb Lazer Silva. Now, he handed around this questionnaire to the rabbis, and the rabbis answered honestly. Number one, they also understood that the sands are shifting. And I'll quote one rabbi's answer. I'm quoting one page, 103 from my work on Silva. By the way, all that I'll mention today, I don't want to mention names of rabbis, but you can find the names in the footnotes. And that way, if you want, you can trace it. The reason I left it out of the text is because sometimes when there's bitter machlokes, kvod Hashem hastadava, not everything has to be mentioned. Try to swallow it. Today it's hard not to mention, because for instance, you take Panovich, what I mentioned yesterday. So over the weekend, tremendous battle broke out again, chairs are flying, and you have movies of it, videos, everything is recorded. You can't deny it today. It's beyond what you can see with your own eyes. So I tried to minimize the mention of names because the machloketvik was very deep and at times very disrespectful. But here, one American rabbi gives a simple example. And you have to understand, all these American rabbis were bilingual. They were raised in homes, every last one, maybe Rabbi Saul B. Friedman, who was the first American-born rabbi ordained by yeshiva, ordained by Reitz in 1919, and I yet had the schut of knowing him. But even Saul B. Friedman, he was born in America, his native language was Yiddish. All the rabbanim spoke Yiddish. They also spoke perfect English. It's like our children growing up in Israel, at least my children are totally at home in English and totally at home in Hebrew. With the grandchildren, very few are totally at home in both languages. I have some that the languages are equal, but it's certainly not the majority. And certainly with the great-grandchildren, there are going to be some who will be totally at home because their mothers, their native, one's granddaughter-in-law is Baltimore. She came in Aliyah from Baltimore. She came in Aliyah after she had it. She's getting a doctorate from Hebrew U. So she came in Aliyah already with a bachelor's. So that great-grandson, his English is delightful. And kid is 2 years old. He already knows Hebrew as well. And then I have another granddaughter-in-law who was born here, but she's the youngest of 7 children. The other 6 were born in London. So there too, her native language is, if I can say that, it's equal English and Hebrew. So the Rabbanim, you take Rabbi Rachman, you take Rabbi Hollander, take Rabbi Schechter Sr., Rabbi Heschel Schechter. They were fabulous speakers in Yiddish and fabulous speakers in English. You're totally at home in both languages. Now, so one Rav writes back to Reb Lazer Silva, when I came into the rabbinate, I started giving shurim and gemara. He says, that was years ago. Today I can't give shurim and gemara. It's too hard for the balabatim. So he says, I teach Mishnayot and I teach Ein Yaakov. And when you hear Ein Yaakov, how many of you remember when I was growing up, all the shirim in every shul were in Yaakov. You had Balabatim, a million Jews in the Bronx, many learned Gemara in Zaya Yugend, and they used to learn Gemara. But later in life, who can concentrate in Gemara? When Yomo opens the Gemara at 10 o'clock at night, believe me, he'd rather open up an Ein Yaakov. And these were Balabatim who worked by day. But it's a very interesting comment. The other Rabbanim, and they were very honest with Reb Lezer, and they tell him, yes, we admit that we don't have the learning of the European rabbis, but we want to have that learning. Don't fault us. Help us. And there's a beautiful letter from Rabbi Simcha Levi. Again, I mentioned the name. You probably don't recognize the name. These were Talmidim of Hakim of the Mechita of Rabbi Revel. It's before Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. But out of the 20s, Reb Simcha Levi later goes on to write Sfarim. His name was Reb Simcha Levi. He was Rav in New Jersey. I believe in Perth Amboy. I may be wrong. It can be checked out. And he wrote a Sefer Simcha Talevi. And he was chairman of the Halakha Commission of RCA before the Rav. When the Rav took over, he took over from Simcha Levi. Simcha Levi and his Sefer, he was matir the microphone on Shabbos. If the guy turns it on, he has correspondence with the people who manufactured microphones in America. And in Baltimore, it's hard to believe today, Simon, you're not going to believe it. Baltimore was in all what you would call today a YU city, and all the big shuls had microphones. Morty, telling the truth or not?
Absolutely.
Baruch Hashem.
Someone refused to take me down with
it. No, beside that. Then. But the Rav came in, and he asked for microphones. And I can tell you, the Tzomet microphone, there's nothing wrong with it. It's only a political question, not a halachic question. If you use a time clock on Shabbos, you can use a Tzomet microphone. It's amazing what they came up with. And I've seen it in action. You don't know where the microphone is there. But it has nothing to do with the old-fashioned microphone where the waves of speech affected the usage of the microphone. But all right, I'm not an expert in physics. I'll leave it for Charlie to analyze and explain. But halacha l'maisa, the Rav asked. And Reb Simcha Levi writes, help us. You want us to get yadin yadin. We're willing to learn. Establish a learning program. And what Reb Lezer Suva did, he organized a joint committee between the Elter Rabbanim, it was Rabbi Silva, and Rabbi Rosenberg, who also had one foot in the modern world. As a matter of fact, his son was a JTS graduate. There was a connection. All I know is that Rabbi Rosenberg's papers wound up in JTS. They had the original papers. They were Xerox. It's also available in Hebrew University, the Institute of Contemporary Jewish Life, or whatever they call it. But it wound up in JTS, Rabbi Rosenberg, Rabbi Silva, and from the YU crowd, I'm using YU in a popular fashion because there wasn't a YU yet, I should really be saying REITs, but people say YU. From the YU crowd, Rabbi Yechiel Chalap, knew who's Rabbi Yechiel Chalap? Rabbi Zvulun Chalap's father. Rabbi Yechiel Chalap, Rabbi William Drazen, who's Rabbi William Drazen? That's the older brother, Rabbi Zev Drazen of Baltimore. And he was the tremendous Talmud Chacham. He later comes to Eliyahu as early as 49, I believe it was. Now, can anyone tell me what he did here? Some Jews, Hachstein, these other Jews, they came in Eliyahu, factories here, to give employment to the masses. Tzedekim Yesod Olam. What did the Hachstein family open here? Mastercraft pipes, exactly. Pipes, who smokes pipes? They opened and it did. Mastercraft went all over the world. It was in a luxurious type pipe. Rabbi Drazen, who becomes chairman of the Moetza Hadatit in Petach Tikva, he opened a pencil factory. And that was the first pencil. In the fifth, every kid who started school yesterday got his pencils from the Dresden pencil factory. Like everything else today, no pencil is made in Israel. Everything is imported from China, etc., etc. Trump is fighting a battle to put America back on the manufacturing map, but you're fighting a losing battle. It's everything is outsourced today. But this was Rabbi Chalap, Rabbi Dresden, and Rabbi Solomon Reichman, Shlomo Reichman. This was Chalap and Reichman, their hashgachas. Rabbi Reichman had two sons. One son lives down the block from me. He was born challenged, and I give the Reichmans all the credit in the world. They raised this kid to function on his own, and he's taken until today. He functions as an apartment. Kol HaKavod, I trust he's still alive. Again, I'm living here 50 years, so I may be thinking, to me, it's 1 year I'm living here. It's 50 years, really. So I may be thinking, I used to meet him on the bus. The other son was one of the top students in YU, or Reitz, went very right-wing, lives in Geula, and friendly with the Soloveitchik dynasty, heads up a kollel that his father raised money for and left an endowment. It's fascinating. So these three people met with Reb Lazer, and they worked out a beautiful tachnit. I have to say, I believe today that this is basically the YU program. You have to know Gemara and Ezekiel and Nashim, all right? The Yeshiva Shemesechta. This is a different problem, that basically in the yeshiva world, students don't go beyond the Zikin and the Nashim. And what about Moed? What about Kudshim? What about Tarot? What about this? There's so much more to Shas and Paiskim. But all right, the basis is Nezikin and Nashim. So no question, if you know how to learn and you develop a Yetzer Tov, you want to go and go further. That's the as far as Gemara. Yes, Yitzchak.
It's interesting that in Maimonides, the Masechtot that we had were Cholin, Shabbos,
right, because the Rev had a different sheet altogether. The Rev sheet was that American kids like you coming off the street of Boston, who what the heck do you see? If he's going to teach you Baba Kama, Bab Metziah, so Shoshanach HaChetapara, little Yitzchak Rubin's going to say, Rebbe, I never yet saw a Shah knocking over a par. But Shabbos, Chulin, Kashrut, all right, this is Halacha Lamaisa. No kid in the world can say, I haven't been exposed to it. Thank God, you heard Havdalah, you heard Kiddush. All right, so this reaches home. This was the Rav Shita, and the Rav was very different. He was basically, even in YU, he introduced Masechtot that no one, I remember the year, remember you, I was in the first Sanhedrin, the famous Sanhedrin Shia of the Rav, right? Remember 57, you weren't there yet. You came in the next year, I believe.
I came in 57.
You came in 57, so you were there.
September 56. But I wasn't in the
Rav Shia. No, but the Rav Shia, 56. No, you were in Rav Hanukh Shia. So the Rav Shia Sanhedrin. So I can tell you, I met Miss Davis in the hallway. And somehow I was friendly. I don't know how I was a kid, but I was a bright kid. You know, I pushed myself. And all right, I met Miss Davis. Miss Davis says to me, Arnold, some of the Rosh Yeshiva are crying. We're going to learn, the Rav decided we're going to learn Sanhedrin next year. And he told me, I don't want to mention the name of Rosh Hashiva, he said, he came to me in tears. He said, I never learned this. I learned so many years. He mentioned the other one, he identified him. And he said, we never learned Sanhedrin. I got to say Sherman Sanhedrin. So now I'll let you in on a secret. When I, again, let me not talk about myself, but I can't avoid it here. Let you in on an interesting secret. So at my wedding, you know, I spoke 22 minutes to Vrei Torah, after the Ketuvah, and there's a picture in, if you don't believe me, there's a picture in Washington of the Rav looking at my notes over my shoulder. So when I finished, I told you, the Rav kissed me, hugged me, kissed me. You can ask Reb Heschel Shechter, he still remembers. Okay. I write in my book, he embraced me, because if I'll say he kissed me, no one will believe me, but he actually kissed me. He never got a kiss from us, I got a kiss. So Mr. Abrams called me in. Ronald, what I never saw in my life. I told Dr. Belkin, and I looked at him. I don't know what he was talking about. So then he explained to me, and I said, all right. He said, the next time we need a Rosh Yeshiva, we're appointing you. All right. I graduate the yeshiva. I'm thrown into the rabbinate, Lower Marian Synagogue. And Taka, I get a telegram Dr. Belkin wants to see you. I write about it in Washington. I think I actually had the date I was there. I never say I was an idiot. I didn't save the telegram. You know, a kid doesn't realize what's valuable. You're still in the Shia Shirim. You know, you think you're going to be singing all your life. Mm-hmm. So I come to the yeshiva. So Dr. Belkin says to me, he totally doesn't mention the rest of me. And he says, oh, I was very impressed. You give a shir for Balabatin in Mayit Cotton? You never learned that in the yeshiva. And then I realized what I was doing in Philadelphia. I had a very learned day. They thought they were Gedolei Yisrael, the congregants, all world famous professors, whatnot. And I taka once a week gave a shir in a private home in Gemara with Rashi, Tosfos, Rambam, and Shir Kedabahi, that you to give it on a level. And I gave in Moed Katan. Why did I give in Moed Katan? Because I never learned Moed Katan in the yeshiva. I figured it's time to start learning to go through Shas. All right, Moed Katan. And Dr. Belton was impressed. In retrospect, I understand already. When you told me about Sanhedrin, and I remember that incident, the Rav had a different viewpoint. But okay, the agreement was reached. They're going to introduce a program in addition to Nashim, Nezikin, and the start of your Adaya, Dinei Kashrut, Shrita, what you learned today already, Shrita is no big deal, because no one is ever going to get a Shaila in Shrita, you're not a Shtat Rav, everything is commercialized today, and everything, it's a unit unto itself. Anyone involved in Shrita is going to be working the Shlachtos, and he has to take exams, and he has to know what he's doing there. But as a Rav Kehila, you're never going to get a Shaila in Shrita. We used to get Shailas and chickens yet in the 40s into the 50s. Empire Kosher ultimately eliminated that. You don't get a Shaila in a chicken today. The chickens are all slaughtered. They go through a whole process in Israel. Rabbi Zsolti used to boast that chickens never were slaughtered more kosher than they're slaughtered in Israel. All right, there's an assembly line. Everything is checked and rechecked. Ah, but then Hilchot Nida. Do you learn that today for Smicha? Hilchot Avelot. Evin Ezra. Sidur Kedushin and Gittin. That's what they wanted every Rav to know. And on that basis, you would get Yadin Yadin in addition to Yorin Yorah. All right? This plan was beautiful. The YU element was happy. The Agudas HaRabbanim element was happy. But a few more years went by, and to be honest with history, some of these Rabbanim were invited to join the Agudas HaRabbanim. Reb Simcha Levi could learn, as well as many Agudas HaRabbanim people. Rabbi William Drazen, he was Zev in Hebrew, Rabbi Natan Drazen, Nathan Drazen, Rabbi Chalak, Rabbi Reichman. But life has a certain drive of its own. Life, it's an old problem, if you know this history of mankind. Who forges history? Is it life that creates great men, or great men that create life situations? And the truth of the matter is, you can't have one without the other. Life has a certain impetus to it, a certain tension, and by the early 30s, it became impossible to bridge the Agudas HaRabbanim with the young rabbis. Life is moving on. The congregations are moving on. There's now a second generation, a third generation born in America. The requests of the Balabatim and Elter Rav cannot start to understand where they are, where they're living. The greatest example in the world is back in January 1st, 1938, there was a pidyon haben for a little kid born in the Bronx. I was present at that event. And my Zayda brought Rav Meskin to be Paidami, Rabbi Yaakov Meskin, until today. It's a very famous name. I just mentioned this name last night to someone. His granddaughter-in-law is partners with my daughter. They've been partners for over 25 years in a legal firm. They have a legal firm together, and very unfortunately for my daughter, I say very successful, because people are standing in line to get divorced. The other part of the partnership is real estate. That's Ken Yerbubi Yisrael. But divorce, it hurts, but that's the reality. So Rav Yaakov Meskin You're talking about the Kehillah Jacob. You're talking about a Talmud Chacham Mufak. You're talking about a man who lived in America for many decades. You're talking about a man who was Matir the Agunat of the Titanic. Right or wrong? He was the one who wrote the Tshuvat Lahatir. The Titanic had a kosher kitchen on it. You're aware of it. They're now auctioning off what they found under sea. They're auctioning off what was sold, a watch in Hebrew. It's unbelievable. There were leichter that were found and silverware with Sadchalavi, Besari. All right? And with all that being said and done, he came to be Paida, this kid in the Bronx. He took the 5 shekel, Paida the kid, and ran, didn't even stay for the meal. And my grandfather was very upset, and gebracht, he probably paid him. And I was there, I saw it all, I understood it all. And I write in Washington, I understand. He was running back, what's he going to do with these American people sitting around, my aunts and uncles, half Jews already, half assimilated. What's going to be, what'll ever be with this kid? Imagine if a Malach would have tapped him on the shoulder and said, Rav Meskin, this little kid that you will Paida, Arnold Edward Rothkopf, one day is going to teach your children Torah and inspire them in Yerushalayim. He would say, ah, it's like Meshuggah, you're crazy. Azah bluff, azah redmin, azah chalom, das kenish sein. You understand? But this captures, so what happened was the American rabbis, it was inevitable with all the good intentions in the world. The OU is starting to grow. It's minor growth, not what's going to happen in the 40s, the 50s. This today, the OU, there isn't a person in the world who hasn't heard of the OU. People look for it. Goyim, who would ever dream that they would come when non-Jews look for the OU, look for Heksha, because they feel it's cleaner. It's on a better hygienic level. And they needed rabbis. So, well, if the OU needed rabbis, they organized a little rabbinical organization. Yeshiva's graduates needed to come together to meet, to talk, to exchange ideas. Pupil dibuk chaverim, very important in life. Networking, what they call today in modern English, networking. The old boys club, call it what you wish. But, in Israel, if you go here and you served in the army, you make 1,000 different contacts. You come here in Olech Hadash, you're an outsider. You're an outsider looking in. That was the new Hebrew word. I told you, when Rabbi Lichtenstein died, all the newspapers had a word I couldn't understand until I realized, Lamrot Shehu Haya Outsider. Even though he was an outsider, Rabarin had a great influence within on the yeshiva chesdon, the level of learning, outsider. And ultimately, by 1935, we'll come to this in much more detail, but not yet, the YU rabbis and the OU rabbis joined together and formed the Rabbinical Council of America. And this cleavage, which was inevitable, and over the years, it only got stronger and deeper. And over the years, as you can understand, the fourth generation was born in America, fifth generation was born in America. And nowadays, the Agudas Rabbanim is basically non-existent halacha lamaseh. There's still a building, they're fighting over who owns it. There may be a baiton that meets occasionally, but you see, the original generation of Americana and Young Israel and RCA and OU, no one knows Yiddish today. Rakefet opens his mouth in Yiddish and has to repeat it in English because people are with big question marks in their eyes. Those who know Yiddish, those are the greenhorns who came after World War II. They look at these Americana Rabbanim. Who are they? What are they? No. Who are Rabbanim? The Rashi Yeshiva. Those that are Hasidish, you're telling me an American rabbi, Chbin Agera Chassid. What are you telling me? Chbin Abelsa Chassid. Chbin Avishnitsa Chassid. Ashpinka Chassid. Wow, what's going on? So you see, they have their own organization. The Satmar Rav was smart. The Central Conference of Rabbis, I think it's called, Union of Earth, of a fancy name. They look at a good at Harabonim. These are old-time Americans who ruined America, compromised. You know, they can find 1,000 complaints in the world. They don't realize 2020 is not what existed in America in 1920. So the Agudas Rabbanim gradually went out of business. The RCA became very powerful and reached peaks, and even today it's the largest rabbinical organization in the world, basically. In 1935, but we'll come back to it in great detail, not yet. But even the RCA today, there's a movement to eclipse it. The Igud HaRabbanim has come back to life. The RCA is not firm enough. It doesn't fight Chobevei Torah strongly enough. You know, each organization has a certain amount of life. And then times move on, shifting gears. It'll be interesting to see what the RCA looks like 20, 30 years from now. All right, but now, coming back to America. The Reeds, the modern so-called rabbis, the Agudas Rabbanim is constantly breathing down their back. Time and again there were clashes. And here you have to understand the money factor. Nowadays, to be an Orthodox rabbi, you take a shtalit, take a shul, you're paid decently. No one suffers in the rabbinate. Look at the Agudas HaRabbanim. Rabbanim, their whole panasa, a shul basically didn't pay a salary. The Rav comes to Boston, a few Orthodox shuls declare him chief rabbi of Boston, whatever the title is worth. They don't give him a salary. But the understanding is, Hechsher is his domain. Well, if you give Hashgacha, they have to pay you. Pesach, you sell chametz, Rabbanim, money, Pesach. Not very divine, but this was the reality. Purim geld, min daf geben der Rav epis. Chanukah geld, got to remember the rabbi. I remember the people, old timers, would give me money. Chanukah Purim, Rebbe, das ist Fachuna, Chanukah Purim, for the kinder. Min daf schlitzen der Rav, all right. I was getting a salary, I wouldn't say much, $4,000 from the Kehillah, out of which YU was paying $2,000. This is Maplewood now, beyond Lower Merion. There, my salary also was $4,000, but it was paid by the Kehillah. No, that's the $4,000 a year. And the yeshiva was paying for that, $8,000 was already a salary. All right. Baruch Hashem. But you see, times the poor Rabbanim, why you guy comes in, he demands dignity, he demands a salary. What will be with the Alter Rav? What are you doing to my Panasa? And let me give you, fill you in, and here you can check out every situation. I saw the documents, some of it, I even interviewed people. Here, 1929, Reb Lazer Silver writes to Rabbi Revel, "We heard you might attend the installation of the new rabbi of the Far Rockaway Synagogue." This may be Lawrence, the shul that later becomes very well known in Lawrence, where Rabbi Kenny Hain is today. That shul is the one I think talking about. Watch. What's it called?
Bet Shalom.
Bet Shalom. "It is known that for the last few years this congregation has been conservative, with men and women praying together. We therefore inform you of the facts and are certain that you will not enter such a synagogue which is constructed in a fashion which transgresses a basic law of orthodoxy." Now, can you imagine, this is Rabbi Revel getting a letter from Reb Lazer Silver. Reb Lazer Silver, now the leading Rav in America. Rabbi Revel, who himself is Chatzi Evet, Chatzi Ben Chorin, half Europeish, half American. And Revel, here his face is being washed in mud. "You're going to go to a shul where men and women sit together?" Now watch how smart Rabbi Revel was. He didn't answer the letter. He gave it over to his assistant. Who is his assistant? Reb Shmuel Leib Zahr. You know him as Dean Zahr. His daughter just died. Esther Zuroff was was the sole surviving child. She just died. There was a son who died. Dr. Eliezer Zarin, Esther Zuroff, married to Abe Zuroff, the wonderful, wonderful people. Shmuel Leib Zahr was Dr. Revel's assistant. Now, Shmuel Leib Zahr was only one quarter Europeish. Three quarters already American. He was in Altatelsia, then he was in England, then his mother went on to South Africa, which affects Torah history with the Rav, but we'll leave that for Shirman the Rav, not for now. And Reb Shmuel Leib, Dr. Revel says, look into this and handle it for me. He looks into it and he writes a letter to Reb Lazer Silver. Listen carefully. He writes, look at the Chachma. What do you mean it doesn't have a mechitza? It has the same mechitza as Rabbi Young's shul on the west side. And if Agudas HaRabbanim would have seichel, they have to do everything to gain these congregations that are on prestigious areas. Your letter to Dr. Revel regarding the rabbi's installation is incomprehensible. Will you, dear rabbi, reconsider your decision so that the Agudat HaRabbanim do not and the yeshiva do not suffer as a result of your directive? No, my dear students, have you ever been into the Jewish Center? The most famous Orthodox congregation, second only to Kehillat Yeshurun, and on a certain level even more important than EJ on the east side, because Jewish Center gave Yeshiva University two of its presidents, Simon Norman Lamb, Rabbi Lamb, and Rabbi Ari Berman. And Rabbi Young desperately wanted to be president. Just think what we're talking about. No? Whoever davened there, Charlie, ever walk into the Jewish Center? I challenge you to find the mechitza. You're coming from Breuers. If you didn't know that that little wooden fence is the mechitza, in a million years you could never tell. And worse than that, Morty, what year is it today? 2019? I was just in the Jewish Center. Nothing has changed. I can't believe it. With all the swing to the right and all the emigres that came. Yes, there are 1,001 shtibbles on the west side. They won't have it in the Jewish Center. But Rabbi Zahr, Dean Zahr was fabulous. You're criticizing the shul in Far Rockaway? The mechitza is exactly like the Jewish Center. Now, that shul, I think they did make a higher mechitza over the years. I don't think you can get away with Far Rockaway Lawrence today with a Jewish Center type mechitza. But this one little example, life be your eyes. Now, a rabbi in New Bedford, this already involves, could even be my own family, my great uncle, my grandfather's brother, Rav Yitzchak Rutkoff, was a Rav in New Bedford in this area. He was a Rav, he was a Sheikhet, I don't know exactly, but this was a Rav. You can read, it's not my uncle who wrote the letter. And he complains to the yeshiva graduate who's been engaged by another local synagogue. The rabbi was needed, I'm quoting from the letter, to lead responsive readings in English from sheets distributed among the worshippers. He also had to read portions of the Machzor in English, although they could themselves read these passages from their own prayer books. Listen to this line. It is even doubtful if most of the congregants understand English. You see what's happening here? The younger generation, this becomes chashivat, important. It's like I went for my doctorate never realizing how much it would change my learning, my knowledge, how much insights it would give me. But I went for my doctorate because I always felt balabatim eat up rabbis. They don't eat up doctors. You have the title, rabbi, doctor. You follow it? English. English. Our rabbi makes a tefillah with a little English. And this Yudapesh Rav, he's dying. And the guy is giving out sheets. And he says, who's he doing it for? the Balabatam are all greenhorns. They don't know English themselves. But yeah, there is an element. You understand, Simon? This is how the conservative movement developed. Watch this. This is Portland, Oregon. By the way, Portland has always had an Orthodox shul, an Orthodox tradition. And you know, in this very kola, I've taught people who married girls who came from Portland, Oregon. I taught there was a student here in Torah Shraga who used to cut Torah Shraga to come to my classes. We came very close. Adam Rosenberg, he helped me immensely when I was in New York this past year. And Adam married a wonderful lady, and Adam came from Portland, Oregon.
The two guys here now.
Two boys in the kola from Portland, Oregon. And here the rabbi's writing to Suva, I plead you to come to my aid. For months I had little Lincoln, and all my hopes centered on this pre-Passover period. Now, this cursed youngster, I'm translating from Yiddish, comes along to take away even this remuneration from me. He too is arranging for the sale of chametz and answering questions concerning the holiday. This young chick, whose eyes have not yet opened, has pushed me aside after my 10 years in this community. Please declare his rulings void and his ordination nullified in an advertisement in the Jewish Morgan Journal. Do not allow the rabbinate to be a lawless world in which anarchy reigns. Do not allow strangers to encroach upon the true rabbanim and desecrate the name of God. Do you feel the tension in that letter? It's pitiful, it's sad. But that's the reality. Here, this is a Yerpeish Rav with a Langer Bod, with a Bekesh and a Ret Geshmak in Yiddish. He speaks a beautiful Yiddish. And here's a young YU graduate, clean shaven in a mutton suit, wears a nice tie, can talk baseball, and the youth is running after him. And this poor Ret, this is the quandary, this is the quagmire. It's a very sad story, but this is the reality. This is the reality. Watch this. Another Rav, you can read the footnotes, you figure out what communities these are. It's another Rav, and he's complaining about a YU graduate. And he writes to Rav Blazer Silva, describing this YU graduate. The rabbi eulogized the wicked Spinoza at a Friday night forum. Those who understood English repeated to me the rabbi's assertion that the rabbanim of Spinoza's era were incorrect in excommunicating such a saintly individual. And you see, Spinoza, you're now touching. Remember when Ben-Gurion declared publicly a whole ceremony welcomed Spinoza back to the Jewish people? And Spinoza remains a question mark until today. Did they do right in excommunicating him? Today we don't excommunicate, because when you excommunicate someone, it just gives him more publicity. But it could be in those days when he was breaking a totally religious community, excommunication was in place. But this rabbi, yes, Yitzchak, you're the philosopher.
I'm afraid that a lot of people who criticized that against Spinoza.
No, say that, of course.
Jordan Kaplan and Spinoza were very similar. He did not believe in a God who intervenes in history. He did not believe in a God who gave law. He did not believe in the authority of the Torah.
Okay.
I believe the authority of rabbis, the rabbinic law for sure is out.
Okay.
In other words, we have a problem. Here is a man who was recognized by the world as one of the greatest
philosophers.
But the one thing he never did, he wouldn't leave Am Yisrael.
Yeah.
He was offered a position at a very, very prestigious university in Germany, but the condition was that he would convert.
Right.
And he said, I do not leave my people.
Right, okay, so now I asked you, would you excommunicate him, yes or no?
At that time, it may have been the
thing. Exactly, that this rabbi is giving a whole talk, but that's not the only complaint. The rabbi also utilized vulgar and uncouth jokes in ridiculing the Yiddish language during his Kol Nidre sermon. This is another problem. Yiddish language, some people maledicted anyone who dared to speak Yiddish. It's a jargon. It's not a real language. No, he understand. He invited speakers to his Friday night forums who drove to the synagogue. Oh, we're going to come to that problem in the Sunday class. Oh, boy. No? Invite a speaker. The Chazanim, what went on in America in the 20s, the 30s? There was a riot in Borough Park in the 1930s. Sirota, one of the famous Chazanim, his driver drove him up on Shabbos Park two blocks away. People saw, they went crazy. They rioted on the street. He had to run for his life. But outside of Borough Park, you could drive up to the shul on Yom Kippur. They used to say about Moshe Aisha that as he would fall along Kairim during Aleinu, and they said he had sandwiches under his talus. That's what they said about Moshe Aisha. All right, you wouldn't find that today. Today, the whole world has changed. Today, Chazanim, I hope you won't find it today. What can I say? If Panovich can go on like Panovich. Last night I cried to my dear friend Rav Avraham Abba Weingut. So that's the Sri Deishis Talmud Mufak post-World War II. So Rav Avraham Abba said to me, Holom Krachit Ragel Panovich. I said, I cry even more, you follow? He said, they've gotten used to this behavior. No one is upset by it. I said, that hurts me all the more that we can get used to this behavior. But I said my vod to this erudite crowd around me that you can teach a monkey how to put on tefillin. Is he a monkey or is he a human? How do you judge him? A monkey putting on tefillin. They like the vod. That vod hit some. All right. Listen to this. The rabbi became angry when one Shabbat before the prayers began, an elder pious Jew rebuked him for his permissiveness. Later, during the sermon, the rabbi called this noble Jew, quote, a great shagetz, end quote. The fishmonger Cohen, it's interesting, he writes the fishmonger Cohen, because the most famous fishmonger in Machne Yehuda is Cohen, right or wrong. And the head of the Mossad, can anyone tell me his name? Cohen. No, he's won every type of prize. They read what the papers are saying about him. By the way, if I felt nishta mincha, he doesn't miss a mincha, let alone shachris mariv. He's a first cousin to the fishmonger in Machne Yehuda. Okay? So the fishmonger Cohen soon demanded that this Jew leave the synagogue. Only through the intervention of some other worshippers was Cohen restrained, and the service finally concluded. And this goes on time and time again. What's worse is the Elter Rabbanim are in a quandary, because if they don't allow some innovation, JTS is breathing down their back. And time and again, I talk about this in Rebel, I talk about this in Silver, graduates of JTS, we're talking the 1930s, come into the Orthodox synagogues, and if Ne'am V'Eda, if we become the rabbi of your shul, we will have part of the service in English. We will allow the men and women to sit together. They throw out these freebies, what they can do, no Orthodox rabbi can do. But the seminary already lived with the concept, if you make small compromises, you keep the people in the temple, you keep the people Jewish. They never dreamt in the 1930s that they would officially permit 20 years later driving to shul on Shabbos. But once the compromises begin, the Balabatim love it. That's a rabbi, this is a rabbi. He's a European rabbi, this is an American rabbi. And the conservative movement is breathing down the back of every Orthodox shul that is seeking and searching to adjust to the new reality. Now, I want to cite a letter to you, which is, to me, crucially important, because it gives you insight what the Balabhatim were thinking at that moment in time. 1930. This is a letter from Savannah, Georgia. It's a letter to Reb Lazer Silva. And very sincere people are writing. And they describe their synagogue. It's always been strictly Orthodox. But they're now young people. And they want, quote, a more attractive form of religious worship. Within these past 30 days, these young people have proven their sincerity by forming an organization called the Judaic League of Savannah. And what they want to do, they want to attract their crowd, their people, their generation. Friday night, their regular services in the shul. Spoke about this in what class? Sunday, Monday, I don't remember. But they also want to have a service later that night, which they're not going to call an official Maariv service, but it'll be very different. The sexes will be sitting together. They want to have a choir, and they want to have English. On the High Holy Days, when the shul is crowded and they need a second worship, area of worship, form of worship, they want to rent some building nearby, some hall nearby, and have more English. Once again, the sexes sitting together. And these people really believe an Orthodox shul can condone this. Opposition has arisen, and when we're very few of the older members to use the synagogue on Friday nights after supper for worship by the younger people along these lines. We are further informed that our rabbi could not be a party to permitting these changes of worship because it's a violation of the tradition and tenets of strict Orthodox Jewry. We speak for 175 young men and young women who are zealous and enthusiastic in our desire to give devotion to our God in keeping with the faith of our forefathers. But these are the type of innovations that will attract these people to the synagogue. We respectfully seek your counsel and advice. And three questions. Is it permissible for men and women to sit together Friday night after supper at semi-regular Orthodox services? Whether it's right and proper during the holy days to use the United Prayer Book at a branch of our synagogue, having both sectors seated together? What they're referring to is a conservative prayer book, which has English. Whether the Orthodox rabbi of our synagogue would be permitted under Orthodox rabbinical practice to lead and participate in these services. And you see what the rabbinate was up against? And these people go and tell them, that's not Orthodox, that's not Torah. They don't speak the same language. They can't comprehend what you're talking about. This is not Teaneck of today. It's not Englewood of today. It's not the Five Towns of today. This is a different era, a different aura, a different environment. These Rabbanim were caught in a quagmire. And some were able to hold for it, and some were not. And this repeats itself in every community you can imagine, right across the length and breadth of the United States. Even the big cities at that time, New York, Boston, Detroit, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Cleveland, every last city, you have this chasm, this cleavage, this split. And the conservative movement has grown very, very big. What's next door? Next door is Machon Lev. Machon Lev began a little institution in Rehov Rav Frank, 1968. You can still see the building. It was built to be a regular building with apartments. Machon Lev took it over, and for a few years, that's where they began. That's where they had their classrooms. This campus was later built, very small when it was built, and expanding all the time. Machon Lev gave birth to another institution, Machon Ora. Baruch Ato Adonai L'melech Olam Shekel Niyamid V'ro. For better or for worse, women today all seek careers. Whether this is good for children, bad for children, don't ask my wife. But this is the reality. So Machon Ora is an institution for girls. How many of you have had contact with Machon Ora? Can anyone tell me who one of the heads is? YU Mismach, give me his name. Rabbi Abba Engelberg. All right. Wonderful individual, essentially my age, maybe a drop younger. Why am I mentioning Rabbi Abba Engelberg? Ma in Shmita Itzel Harsinai. Cleveland, one of the greatest battles ever fought over an Orthodox synagogue becoming a conservative temple, was fought in Cleveland. And the man who battled for the continuation of Torah was Abba Engelberg's grandfather, Mr. Abraham Katz. A book should be written on this controversy itself. There's a world of material. We're going back to the 1920s, going back to this very period we're talking about. We're back to a conservative rabbi by the name of Solomon Goldman. Solomon Goldman, born in Europe, came to America a kid from parents, like many others, studied at what today is Yeshiva University. From Yeshiva University, went on to the seminary, was ordained in 1918. He reaches Cleveland. Cleveland has a big East European community. This is one of the big shuls in Cleveland, and Rabbi Goldman introduces change after change. Mixed seating Friday night during the late services abolishes the Korim on Yom Kippur. Primitive, what is it doing in a synagogue? The Avoda abolished. Shul dinners abolishes Netilat Yadayim. No need for ritual washing. We have fountains, water in every house. Everyone is clean. No need for kippot. Men can sit at the dinners with no head covering. What? No. At the dinners, not during the davening. In the conservative temple, yet they're wearing kippot. Shabbos, without an Erev, he carries books through the streets on Shabbat to the synagogue. When he performs a marriage ceremony, at the end of the wedding, the rabbi kisses the bride. All right. Now you have to know, Minig HaMakom was, at the end of every wedding ceremony, the groom kissed the bride under the chuppah. There's, Rakepit was criticized, shot at, his face smacked, because in the documentary on the Rav that he brought into the world, I have to say single-handedly, there's nothing ever in my life that I did single-handedly, but everyone laughed at me, said it will never be, and Baruch Hashem, that documentary has won awards. Okay, In the documentary, the producer found some movie footage of a wedding that the Rav was Masada Kedushin in Boston. And it goes very quickly. And look carefully, right at the end of the ceremony, the Chatan is kissing the bride. How do you allow that into a documentary, Chatan kissing the bride? Idiot! That's what America was about. Morty, you want a proof? Tell your little story, but it doesn't go for nothing. 36 grand to the IOU list, and you're getting a bargain. 38. No, Simon, what do you know about Torah history? Which great European Rosh Yeshiva came to America in 38? They pleaded with him to remain, but he insisted on going back and later killed by Hitler, the great Rebbe Elchanan Wasserman of Brunovich. No, he was raising funds for Brunovich. He was in Brooklyn. He lived, he stayed near Torah Vadas. Made a big impact. I know a lot of Torah Vadas young men later followed him. Then they had to come back a year later. And he was a wealthy balabas. Rebbe Chulis of Masadas Gilan Kedushin. If I'd given $100, I'll give $100 for Brunovich, which is a fortune of money. Be Masada Kedushin for my children. Rebbe Chana's Masada Kedushin. And Minig America, the Chatan gives the bride a big kiss under the chuppah. Rebbe Chana got very upset. So afterwards, the Talmidim, Freya said to the Rosh Yeshiva, what are you so upset about? Was Nenten Sahad said, they signed for Herit, they're married. And Rabbi Chanan said, take a look at the Torah. What are the last words? Le'enei kol Yisrael. Certain things, if you do it, le'enei kol Yisrael, it's the end of the Torah. Did you know that story? That's Rebbe Chanan. Worth $36,000 or not? What do you say? A bargain? Okay. Baruch Hashem. Charlie, what a story. Here the rabbi is kissing the bride. Forget about the Chatan and Kala kissing. The rabbi is kissing the bride. You should know that this went to court. I believe Mr. Katz was a lawyer, and they went to court. This became a very, very famous court case. Who do you think was the expert witness called into court? Reb Lazer Silver. And his entire testimony is available. I produce it as an appendix, by the way, in the Silver era. But you gotta believe, you can't believe some of the questions he's asked. Suppose a rabbi says from his pulpit to his congregation that the story of the flood is a myth and no foundation fact, and that a 12-year-old boy would not believe it. Rabbi, is that considered within or without? And Reb Lazer answers, I view it as heresy. You understand, everyone hits. There was just some Orthodox rabbi, I think from Chovevei Torah, someone got involved already in biblical criticism, and the whole flood story, it's the first thing they throw away. It's nothing new. But there is a tradition among general literature, the Gilgamesh epic, I think it is, that there was a flood. You understand? There's so much proof. But no, who committed? There was the conservative rabbi in Los Angeles, Rabbi Wolpe. He threw out Yetziat Mitzrayim, that there's no God. What's left? What do we Jews believe in? Yetziat Mitzrayim, it's all out. Rabbi, how do you view the kissing of brides by the rabbi during the marriage ceremony? Of Lazer answers, it is said that when a man does this, we cannot believe him even as a witness. And he gives, you know, he's Pasuliatus, he gives a whole flock of stories. Anyway, this machlokas totally split the community. Ultimately, one part of the community remained frum, the other part left and organized a conservative temple. But the anti-Rabbi Golden feeling was so great that he left and he became a conservative in Chicago, where he remained for the rest of his life. And people tell me in Chicago, when he got up to preach, it was like Moshe Rabbeinu coming down from Har Sinai. Ah, he was world famous conservative, but he was really conservative. This wasn't a Orthodox rabbi making compromises or a conservative rabbi. He was mainstream conservative. And then the problem that haunts us until today. We have not solved the problem, and it's amazing to me how my young students listening to these lectures, older people, smart people, people who are living Mishle, referring to yesterday's Hesped, still come up with the solution and still wonder why we can't enact it. My dear friends, life has a lot of problems. The fact that we have to eulogize a student 20 years younger than we are, who dies without children, with no one to say Kaddish, no one to sit Shiva, isn't that a terrible problem? The fact that people come back with bad reports from doctors, isn't that a terrible problem? All right, we have to do what we can to overcome. Whoever will discover the ultimate cure to cancer will be worth our adoration 100%. But we have a terrible problem in our world that's not created by the vicissitudes of life. It's created by man. And that, of course, is the man-made Aguna. By the way, in Israel today, their official statistics, there are more Agunim than Agunat. You follow? It was in yesterday's newspaper that there are more women who refuse to accept Gittin and torture their husbands than husbands torturing their wives in Israel. They're amazing. But all right, we have power here. But the man-made Aguna is a terrible, heartbreaking problem. I'm now involved with another case in Baltimore. Baltimore seems to have some classic man-made Aguna problems. All right. I've done what I can for the last 2 years. I hope there's some progress. My dear students, I'll make a simple proposal. Simon, are you married yet? Not yet. All right. B'sha tovu mitzlachat. You're going to get married the night of your wedding, right after the chuppah. You will authorize your wife, whom I hope you will be beloved, although at the end of 2 minutes, I don't want to use that word. When you're married 50 years, I will then say, Simon and his beloved wife. At the end of 2 minutes, we got time to see. I don't give a mazel tov for 1 year. Come back to me 1 year later. I don't want to waste breath. I'll give a mazel tov. Okay. And you, Simon, the Rebbe mispronounces your name because he was raised Italiana. Italianda, come on. Italiana, let's speak Italian already, or Yiddish Italian. So you will authorize your wife that she can call upon any Rabbanim, any Seifrim, any witnesses to write a get on your behalf, divorcing her when you have left home and no one knows where you are for 3 years. When the court has declared you have to give a get and you refuse. Wow. Imagine right after the wedding, you give the authorization. It's a beautiful idea, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Essentially, the main reason it doesn't work is because 2 minutes later, you can go into a different room and call together two of your gambling buddies, who you know, the Major League Baseball now. Atlanta has a team, the Yankees, New York, we have a little bet, a little Misachek Bekuvia. And you'll say to your two buddies, gentlemen, I just gave an authorization to my wife that she can have it get written under such and such circumstances. But I love my wife and I don't want to have the talk of get. And I renounce and abolish and nullify any intention to have a get written for my wife. There's nothing in the world that can stop you. In addition, and this is open halacha, I lectured on this, I gave sources. Person gets married. In the ketuvah, you obligate money to support your wife. She obligates to live with you in the normal fashion of a married couple. Every time you live together, the Achronim say that abolishes any desire to divorce her. So that this, in theory, doesn't get off the floor. I'm dealing with it now. A Talmud proposed it. And again, it's the same story. Someone in Israel, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, came up with a very similar proposal, and they shot it down in Makor Rishon. It comes up. It's haunting us.
What about a prenup?
Prenup is a different story altogether. There, you shouldn't be Masada Kedushin today unless the couple signs a prenup. But a prenup doesn't give authorization to give a get. It just makes a commitment to go to Beit Din, and if you don't go and they've declared you have to give a divorce, so you're fined. And most normal people are going to give a get if they're going to have to give $10,000 a month if they don't give a get. But prenup is a different story. And in Israel, Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg accepts it. And my daughter has written many prenuptial agreements. But that's not an authorization to give a get. There's a tremendous difference. Gentlemen, in the mid-30s, a Rav in Brookline, a Rav in Boston, Rabbi Louis Epstein, a 1930 graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary, rabbi of a very prestigious, if not the most prestigious, congregation in all of Boston, and I'm conservative, Kehilat Israel. It already was in Brookline, which was a fancy neighborhood. Rabbi Louis Epstein was not an Amoritz. He had learned in Europe, came to America, was a Rav, what you would call by today's standards, right-wing conservative. He made this proposal, and there was literally World War III. The entire Orthodox rabbinate rallied against it. The Agudas HaRabbanim then, which was the powerful rabbinate, the RCA was basically non-existent, just getting started by 35. 35, it reached the crescendo, this machloket. And that machloket, Reb Leizer Silva, led the way. This Agudas HaRabbanim, ad kan, they took on the conservative movement. Who are you? What do you know? And they wrote shivat against them. Pardes was written. Excuse me. The conservative backed off.
What did he do?
They wrote, what do you mean, what did he do? They refused to accept it. They said, this will not work. The children will be mamzerim. No legitimate Beis Din can accept it.
What did he do?
What did who do?
Rabbi Louis Epstein.
Oh, Rabbi Louis Epstein. The rabbinic assembly accepted it halacha l'maisa. That they're going to have the chatan given authorization to his wife to write a get at every wedding ceremony. Halacha l'maisa, it was accepted. Yeah, I read these words, it's not important. This innovation was accepted by his colleagues and later abandoned because of total opposition of the Orthodox rabbinate and some members of the Jewish Theological Seminary's faculty. You got to remember, they had some people there, Boaz Cohn, among others, who knew how to learn, even Louis Ginsberg. How do you... The husband was to authorize a messenger to deliver the get to my wife in case I shall desert her for 3 consecutive years or civilly divorce her. I swear that I shall not annul this authorization or the subsequent get which will be issued. But you can swear from today to tomorrow. If he annuls it, he annulled it. All right. This was Reb Leizer. This is Agudas HaRabbanim. These are the 1930s. This problem haunts us until today. There is no easy solution. In the state of Israel, we have solved 99% of these problems. The rabbinate has power. The state has power. Even the Supreme Court, which has been leftist and has made decisions that sicken any Torah on this issue, it's unbelievable. They made a unanimous decision that Israel is the guardian of every Jew in the world, and when men wind up in Israel, they don't let them leave till they give a get eye. They scream with American citizens. Doesn't help. There's a case right now with a foreign lord. You know what's going on. There's a case right now with a Chassidish Yid who won't let his son give a get. Torture the woman. Don't give her any money. And they're suing him here in Israel and obligating. Evidently has property here. The fortune of money will go to the woman every day, more and more money, until the son gives a get. And it's a Beit Din, I believe, in Tel Aviv. Kol HaKavod. By the way, the Bat Dinim in Tel Aviv and Haifa, they say, are on a much higher level, and they understand the modern world very well. But more than that, and I want to end off this chapter. In addition to all these questions, Reb Blazer was involved in Dinei Torah. Jews have a machlokes. You're supposed to go to Rabbanim. In the state of Israel, you all know you have a choice. You can go to a Beis Din or you can go to a Beit Mishpat on civil matters, monetary matters. Kudas Rabbanim, from Jews occasionally came there. The questions they got were very, very fascinating. One question that I understand so well, because I was involved in a similar question, the Diskin Orphanage. All of you know that in Givet Shaul, there's an old building that originally was one of the biggest buildings in Jerusalem, and was an orphanage. Today, it's far from an orphanage. They're kollelim, it's rented out. Someone left money for Diskin Orphanage, and it went to court, actually. My good friend, Rabbi Roy Albert, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, he was involved in the case. Of course, he said, how can it go to Diskin Orphanage? It's no longer an orphanage. And he fought to get the money to go to better causes that he felt the lady really wanted to give it to. Something that was religious and Zionist, not something from the old world. It was a big machlekes. But this machlekes in the 30s was something else. Diskin Orphanage had an office in New York. Vic, what does it cost to run an office in New York? You need an office, you need a secretary, you need telephones, you need a salary for the fundraiser. By the time the fundraiser got finished, he raised $100,000 a year and his expenses were $98,000 a year. And they went to court. He said, no, you can't fire me. And I want to tell you, we had this with Shvat Ami. We ultimately got rid of a real office in America because now with instant communication, it's much cheaper to run out of Israel than to have a separate office in America. In America today, I have a Talmud, let him remain nameless. He told me he's doing fundraising for this institution and he has an office in Hillcrest. And he gives me an address. So Malk and I went to see the office. I couldn't understand why an office, it's a small institution, I know what it costs. It's a mailbox they have in America, UPS, they collect, they take, they send. You can rent a mailbox there. So that Aaron Rakefet has an office on Fifth Avenue. Office for saving the Jewish people. No one has ideas as good as we have to save the Jewish people. And Baharaya, we have a Fifth Avenue address. Oh boy. Go to Fifth Avenue and all you'll see is a little, yeah, it's a Fifth Avenue address. They get the mail every day. They have 120 boxes, this jerk, this dummy, this phony, and they put them in to each. So you should know he had to deal with this question, and they reached a very interesting conclusion. Yes, it doesn't pay to continue an office in America. The fundraising can be directed from Jerusalem. But yet this man worked for you for so many years, give him a pension. He can't be fired without his social needs being taken care of. Let me do one more question and I'll leave the big one for next week. And then we're not next week, but 2 weeks, but then we roll. Vad Hatzalah, wow. One more question today. I wrote a lot about this and lectured on it. Tell me, Could you imagine Torah Shraga, the faculty feels they're not being paid properly? You just have a strike now, the Maunot. No, anyone who has a little kid, my great grandchildren can't go, their mothers can't go to work, can't go to university, can't finish their doctorates. What goes on? Tell me. The teachers in Torah Shraga declare a strike. Charlie, what do you say? Are we allowed to strike? When did this come up? Halacha lemaisa, the Depression years, right around the corner from where you grew up, Yeshiva University, where you went to school. Everyone is striking. Do you have any idea how much money was owed to every teacher? What went on in the 30s? Why Rabbi Revel died so young and so much heartache? Are you allowed to strike? Simon, what do you want to do with life? Let me hear.
Counseling.
What I can't hear?
Counseling.
You want to be in the rabbinate or not?
Yeah.
A little. Are you allowed to take a salary to be in the rabbinate to teach Torah? Am I allowed to take a salary for teaching yesterday, teaching today? Jack, what do you say? Absolutely not. No? The Rambam. Take a look in Hilchot Talmud Torah. Take a look in the Rambam on Pirkei Avot, Kadam Lach Pavo. Take a look. My. Oh, I deserve a fortune. Not for teaching, for preparing the lectures. Oh boy. This is Yesh Me'ayin. Come on. The sources, what I quoted yesterday, the Favofener of Moshe. By the way, the book on Kaddish, my Talmud Steve Ross told me it's available online. You don't have to buy it. You can see it online. If you're used to reading, I can't read online. It's too hard. I have to have a book in front of me. But it's available, he said. They want to publicize what they're doing. It's a whole series of books. Evidently, this MTA graduate, Birnbaum, was that in your time? What was the first name? David? What name did I give you yesterday? David could be. Anyway, he seems he's done well in his endeavors, and he just wants to perpetuate Yiddishkeit in a more popular, open fashion. So here's what happened. David, right? David Birnbaum.
Yeah, so some rabbis that charge money for their weekly Parsha study. They were killed, but they cost money.
I'm not here to criticize anyone, but this is a delicate question. Rabbis speak on Shabbos, preach on Shabbos. You're a scholar in residence on Shabbos. If you, off the cuff, there's some people, they give the same talk wherever they are, they repeat themselves, they don't care, whatever it is. I've seen scenes with Balabatam with fury. Is this what we're paying for? I heard this guy, you know, it's... He's not allowed to take money. Rakefet speaks on Shabbos. You are darn right he's allowed to be paid. He worked hours to put that shit together, to find the sources, to be a native. So it's a very serious question. You should know that RJJ in the 1930s, the famous school established in memory of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the chief rabbi, the Depression, they went on strike. And the Balabatim of RJJ called them to Din Torah. And this was a Din Torah with no less than five famous Rabbanim in the New York area. And they rebuked the faculty. Why did you strike? Arbitration. It's the Depression. It's difficult. RJJ wanted to get rid of like 12 teachers. They did their research. 9 had to be reinstated. No complaints against them. 3 had to be given severance pay. At YU, what happened during the 30s, and this my research uncovered, Rabbi Palayev told me, the college faculty struck. The MTA faculty struck. There were terrible times. The Reeds faculty held the meeting. Maybe they should strike. And Rav Palev said, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik told him, I'm not talking about the halacha, but he said, Was machen sich narisch? What are we making ourselves into fools? If we strike, they'll take students studying for the rabbinate and appoint them to give shiurim. Students, what do they need? They need a gadol hador to give a shiur. You know what Rabbi Revel used to complain about? I have too many Rashi yeshiva and not enough melamdim. Are you reading me? I can tell you, I don't want to mention names here, but some of my students have from the Kollel. So I remember one student said to me, I studied with this very famous Rosh Yeshiva 2 years. He said, I wasted 2 years of my life. I said, what are you talking about? It's an Adam Gadol. He said, yeah, but I was a kid who needed a derech in Gemara. I didn't need all the achronim and thrown at me. I needed basic shas and basic rishonim. I didn't get it. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the insight here, not bad at all. They'll take some of the yeshiva guys, Rabbi Revel, you know, you're meshubit to Rabbi Revel, you're meshubit, you want to get smicha from the yeshiva, do us a favor, while strike is on, we don't want Beetle Tera, start teaching. Before you know it, when we want to come back, they'll say, we don't need you, we have cheaper help. They never struck. To the credit of the Reeds faculty, they never struck. It leaves with one more important question, which has influence on all of subsequent Torah history, might even have influence on some of the young people here in this kollel, but we'll leave that for next time. And then we roll into Var Hatzalah. Oh boy. Heavyweight. So to reiterate, I'm making up a new language. To reiterate, what did we do today? We dealt with the Agudas Rabbanim when they're still powerful. But the inevitable is happening. A new rabbinate is growing up under their nose. And you see, that's life. You go back to 1948, the state is declared. We were as ready to teach Torah in the state of Israel as I am to dance a kazatska in front of Mao Zedong at this moment. 70 years later, look what we achieved here. The entire structure, who would ever dream that Litvashi Yeshiva, the language of instruction, would be Hebrew? Think for a minute what I just said. Not Yiddish. Who would ever dream in Litvashi Yeshiva a third of the population or more would be Moroccans, Tunisians, Libyans, every type of Sephardic country you can imagine. The religious Zionist world, who could ever dream we would engender an entire educational system for millions of students ultimately, totally geared to plant Torah on the Israeli scene. Who would ever dream? Yeshivat Hezda, Ulpanot, the Shnat Sheirut, all the different types of schools, all the different opportunities. What kids can achieve today. Who would ever dream that at Hebrew University on student day, when you get drunk and carry on like it's Purim, falling on Simchas Torah, that they demand separate celebrations for men and for women? It's beyond words. Who would ever dream that my own grandchildren can go to the Technion and meet fabulous religious girls who are also students in the Technion? It's unbelievable what we've achieved here. And still achieving, still evolving. That's the strength of life. And it goes way beyond any individual. It's built in to the way God made the world. We can have great people, but great people have to know how to harness the horse, how to harness the times, how to utilize it constructively. All right, B'ezrat Hashem, next week, It's today is Monday. Next week on Monday, we'll be very busy hearing Tkiyat HaShofar almost at this time. There are no classes next week, obviously. The week afterwards, Sunday, Monday, there are classes. Tuesday's Erev Yom Kippur. Wednesday is Yom Kippur. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we almost have no time to prepare for Sukkot. Shabbos, Friday interrupt. But somehow, Chazakah, Mark, we will get there. Those will be the last classes till after the big break for Sukkot, and then we'll pick up again this year. There's no problem. Sukkot ends a week earlier, we pick up a week later. Everything is back to normal without any question. Now, Yitzchak, this is for you. I want to remind everyone the Shloshim tribute in honor of the esteemed memory of our beloved Rabbi Yosef Klausner Yedidya, Thursday evening, September 6th at the OU Center. I'll be speaking, Rabbi Mordechai Machlis, who's a great individual, Rabbi Eliyahu Dordak, who I have a feeling is a son of a student of mine, and your participation will be a cherished blessing an elevation of his holy neshama, if anyone wants a copy. I have a lot of material. This is unbelievable. A telegram to Rabbi, from Reb Lazer Silva to the Rav, telling the Rav that he just heard his uncle's home, Reb Lazer's Rebbe, Reb Velvel, that his home was hit by a bullet, a bomb, a missile, during the War of 48, and they need money to repair it. And Reb Lazer says, I just sent them $300, and Reb Riv sent $200, and we hope that you'll be able to send at least $500. We have ways to transmit. Rabbi E. Silver says, a very, very interesting document. Russia's chief rabbi paid a secret visit to Tehran. Putin is the greatest advocate the Jewish people have. Rabbi Lazar, what he did in Tehran, guaranteed food for Pesach, etc. And he's back there again now. Putin's going with a committee and he's on the committee. French city, Rouen, if I'm pronouncing it right, near Paris. It's reopening a building that is the oldest yeshiva building in the world. It was discovered, it's 12th century, and they refurbished it. With the Pope, what is going on?